University and moves back and forth year by year from this university to that university. I'm told by the chairman of the department, in fact, that this is perhaps, did you say the 20th such lecture or something like that? So it's been in service for some time. Tonight, we are very pleased to have a young scholar, let's say. We're all the same age here. In the field of Islam, Dr. William C. Chittick, who's the professor of religious studies at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. He is a graduate of Tehran University and has been publishing in the field for some years, a number of works on Shiism, more recently works on Sufism, two in particular that I'm certain many of you are aware of, one on Jalaluddin al-Rumi, the Sufi path of love early in the 80s, and a second one, the Sufi path of knowledge, a book on Ibn al-Arabi, both of which have been well received, contain materials and manners of exposition that in fact have really opened up the field of interest for people who, not able perhaps to read the original languages, now can benefit from the excellent work which Dr. Chittick has done on these two great expositors of the Sufi way in Islam. Welcome, Dr. Chittick, and his talk tonight is on Sufi. Okay, what is it?
Sufi views of Adam's fall.
Sufi views of Adam's fall. Okay.
Thank you. This. Who set this up? Sorry, I didn't touch that. There was a time, not too long ago, when to say that something was a myth could only mean that it was false. To discuss it seriously was beneath the dignity of a modern person who had now gone beyond the need for stories. We, after all, deal only in truths and realities, or should I say facts. Fortunately, this time has passed for most people, especially now that Joseph Campbell has appeared on a television series about myth and, as it were, placed religious mythology in the sacred context of the great oracle of modern myths. In the field of religious studies, given the work of Mircea Eliade and others, it has long been recognized that myth provides the paradigms for human culture, the models whereby human beings have shaped their lives and brought themselves into harmony with a reality that lies beyond all appearances. Among Western myths, the fall of Adam and Eve has lately been receiving more attention than usual. In most circles, people no longer worry about the historicity of the account, but instead focus on its meaning and its interpretation. They recognize that the story of Adam and Eve has had a deep influence on the way that Jews, Christians, and Muslims have lived their lives over the centuries. As feminist scholars have been quick to point out, the role of women in Western culture has often been justified by interpreting this myth in certain specific ways. And hence many feminists have offered alternative interpretations, if not alternative myths, with the aim of rectifying certain perceived wrongs. In the Islamic context, the basic story of Adam and Eve is set down in the Quran. But there are significant differences in detail from the Hebrew Bible account. And understanding these differences can help us grasp the Islamic view of human nature. Throughout Islamic history, Muslim thinkers have offered interpretations of this myth with a view toward bringing out the implications of the Quranic account and applying them to everyday life. Given that the Islamic tradition provides a different version of the myth in the first place, and in the second place, interprets it from perspectives that are sometimes unfamiliar to the Judeo-Christian tradition, investigating Islamic accounts can help us understand not only the religion of Islam, but also the implications of our own understanding of the myth. But before I enter the main topic of my talk, let me first say something about the title. The term Sufi is liable to misunderstanding, since it has been used in a wide variety of senses, some positive and some negative. I should clarify what I have in mind, so that hopefully people will not react by saying, "Oh, that's Sufism. It has nothing to do with Islam." Or, "That's just mysticism." I have long noticed the ease with which certain topics in Islamic studies can be dismissed, especially by scholars who should know better, simply because many people have filed Sufism into a certain cubbyhole that does not correspond to their own perception of what is important. For my own part, I am not using the term to refer to any of the specific historical movements or figures that have employed the name for themselves, though they are not necessarily excluded. What I have in mind is a certain perspective upon things present already in the Quran that has sometimes been stressed and sometimes put off to the side throughout Islamic history. Sufism, in this sense, refers to that dimension of Islamic life and thought that emphasizes meaning over form, spirit over body, significance over bare fact, love over obedience, hope over fear, mercy over wrath. Defined in this way, Sufism appears as the inner life of Islam. One might use instead the term Islamic spirituality. For the purposes of today's discussion, it is sufficient to keep in mind that the Sufi dimension of Islam stresses God's nearness, mercy, and compassion, while the juridical dimension, whose primary concern is putting the Sharia, the revealed law, into practice, emphasizes God's distance, justice, and wrath. The leitmotif of Sufi teaching can be summarized in the prophetic saying, "God's mercy precedes his wrath." The jurists, of course, cannot deny this, but in practice they emphasize God's kingly and lordly qualities more than his loving and gentle qualities. For them, God is a king to be obeyed without question, not a sweet friend with whom one can come to an intimate understanding. Given the fact that most Sufis stress the priority of God's goodness and compassion, it is only natural that they place emphasis on the positive side to Adam's fall. And given the fact that Sufis are not overly concerned about form and details, they place stress upon the spirit and the meaning of the myth. This leads to a great deal of reflection and meditation. And as a result, I speak of Sufi views in the plural, since there is not a single view shared by all Sufis. On the contrary, different Sufis have offered a variety of interpretations, and single individuals frequently provide different, and even in certain senses, conflicting meanings to the same details of the story. As for the word Adam, I use it in my title as it is frequently used in the Islamic tradition, to refer to the original human being, and by extension to all human beings. There is no suggestion that anyone, such as female human beings, is excluded. The fall of Adam is the fall of everyone, though the question of the distinction that is often made between Adam and Eve is a fascinating one. It is secondary to the question of the human situation, and frequently our authors do not even mention the distinction. Instead, they discuss what the myth signifies for our existence as human beings, whether we be men or women. Most authors classified as Sufis have something to say about Adam's fall. And although certain general themes can be found, I find it more interesting to investigate the interpretations that are not so common. In any case, the topic I have chosen is impossibly vast unless certain limitations are placed upon it. Hence, I will restrict myself to speaking about a single author, and in fact, a single work. The author in question died in 534 of the Islamic calendar, the year 1140, the Common Era, and wrote the first major commentary in Persian on the divine names, a work whose title can be translated as The Ease of Spirits in Explaining the Names of the All-Conquering King. The author's name is Ahmad Sam'ani, and he lived most of his life in Marv, which is located in present-day Turkmenistan in the Soviet Union. Do not be surprised if you have never heard his name. I only came to know about him a few months ago when I received a copy of his book, which was just published last year. I quickly realized that this 600-page work is one of the great masterpieces, not only of Sufism, but also of Persian literature. I could go on at length talking about its virtues, but instead I will provide a few sample passages concerning the fall of Adam to illustrate both its content and its style. Sam'ani repeatedly comes back to the Quranic account of Adam's fall, providing a number of different perspectives on its significance. Some of his interpretations are common in earlier or later Sufi literature, and some I have not met with elsewhere. I certainly know of no other Islamic text that devotes so much attention to the meaning of the fall. And I also know of no other prose work with such originality, freshness, rich use of poetic imagery, and sense of humor. The work most similar in spirit is the Masnavi of the great poet Jalaluddin Rumi, which was written about 120 years later than this work by Sam'ani. Many of you may not be familiar with the Islamic account of Adam's fall. It can be told briefly as follows. I leave out many details, but I mention those details that are especially important in Sam'ani's eyes. God decided that he would set in the earth a vicegerent, a representative. Before creating the vicegerent, he informed the angels about his decision. They seemed to be somewhat taken aback, since they said, I quote, "What? Wilt thou place therein one who will do corruption there and shed blood while we glorify thee in praise and call thee holy?" This is Quran 2:30. God replies simply that he knows something that the angels do not know. Having created Adam, God teaches him all of the names. These names are the names of everything, or the names of God, or both, depending on various interpretations. God asks the angels the names, but they admit their ignorance. Then God has Adam teach the angels the names and reminds the angels that he had said that he knew something that they did not know. Then he commands the angels to prostrate themselves before Adam, and all of them do so except Iblis, or Satan. When God asks Iblis why he refused, Iblis says, "I am better than he. You created me of fire, and you created him of clay." The fact that God created Adam of clay, or stinking mud, is mentioned several times in the Quran and described in some detail in the sayings of the Prophet, the Hadith literature. In brief, God took a handful of earth and kneaded it for 40 days with his own two hands. Then he breathed into it from his own spirit. Perhaps at this point he offered the trust, al-amana, to the heavens, the earth, and the mountains, but they all refused. The human being, here the term al-insan is used instead of Adam, the human being carries the trust. And the Quran tells us, in concluding the verse, he is a wrongdoer, ignorant.